Last week, when we left off our study in the book of Genesis, we were looking in chapter 24 and the first part of chapter 25, and we were seeing the details of a very delightful story last week, didn't we? It was the story of finding a bride for Isaac. Are you all familiar with the Jimmy Swaggart Ministries? Well, he's a charismatic, as you know, and I cruise past that channel every now and then on my cable, and I like the music guys they got. They got great musicians there. I wouldn't care too much for their pneumatology, but at any rate, I was cruising by there a little bit, and his son was talking about this same incident and all of the types that we saw in it. And I thought he was right about most of them. He said Isaac was a type of Christ. I would agree with that. And the Holy Spirit was a type of, or the servant was a type of the Holy Spirit. Rebecca was a type of the bride. But he said the camels were a type of tongues. And that's when I had to change channels, because I thought he was doing okay up until that point. I can't quite see that link, but at any rate, the Assemblies of God types, they can see that, I guess, but I couldn't. Anyway, in that story last week, we did see those types, and they were, I think, pretty clear for us and not all that hard to discern. And it was an illustration of the principle of divine providence. There's a lot of them in the Old Testament. This one was a good one, good, clear, and easy to see how God controls the circumstances of our lives. And we could see him doing it in that storyline quite nicely. And the character that we saw, the actors in that story, were displaying some very admirable characters in most cases. Isaac, we had seen earlier in his life, displaying some exemplary behavior when his father offered him up for sacrifice, or just about did. Rebecca displayed some very admirable characteristics. She seemed to be a very industrious, hardworking, friendly young lady. Very positive vibes came out of that whole story last week in the selection of a wife for Isaac. But there is a change that we'll see take place as we go forward here a little bit, and I want to just kind of relate it to you to a poem. You may have seen or heard this poem before. It's kind of popular, by a guy named Robertson McQuilkin. Let Me Get Home Before Dark. Yeah, you ever heard that poem? The sentiments of the poem have to do with how we finish our lives as believers. We've seen in Rebecca and Isaac's case a good start, have we not? I mean, they're pretty admirable characters, seem to me. I'll read you a little bit of this poem. I won't read the whole thing. It's a little longer than, I'll read about half of it here, but you'll get the sense, I think, of what this poem is about, and it relates to what we're going to see going forward. So let me read this to you, a little bit of it at least, first couple of stanzas. It's sundown, Lord. The shadows of my life stretch back into the dimness of the years long spent. I fear not death, for that grim foe betrays himself at last, thrusting me forever into life, life with you, unsoiled and free. But I fear the dark specter may come too soon, or do I mean too late, that I should end before I finish, or finish but not well, that I should stain your honor, shame your name, grieve your loving heart. Few, they tell me, finish well. Lord, let me get home before dark. Second stanza, and we'll quit there. The darkness of a spirit grown mean and small, fruit shriveled on the vine, bitter to the taste of my companions, burdened to be borne by those brave few who love me still. No, Lord, let the fruit grow lush and sweet, a joy to all who taste. Spirit sign of God at work, stronger, fuller, brighter at the end. Lord, let me get home before dark. And then there's a couple more stanzas. The sentiment this guy is expressing is one that we can probably all identify with and perhaps share from time to time, and that is that we finish our Christian walk with the Lord well. How many people do you know that when they were younger and through the prime of life led an exemplary Christian life, had a good testimony for the Lord and so on and so forth, but as they aged and approached the end of their life, things changed and they became grumpy old men, sourpusses that nobody even wanted to be around, and they did not end well. In theory, the longer we walk with the Lord, the more gracious we should be. But do you see that in life? That doesn't usually happen so much, does it? A lot of times we don't finish well in our Christian walk. And that poem kind of tries to capture that sentiment. And of course, it appeals for not failing like that. And the reason I bring that up and mention to you as we go forward here now, especially with the last part of Isaac's life, we'll see that Isaac did not finish well. Neither did Rebekah. Neither one of them did. They would have benefited from this prayer for themselves, but we'll see that as we go. We'll let that develop through the narrative here, the scriptures that we'll see, but it's a case, unfortunately, in scripture of starting well, but not finishing well, and we'll see that. So let's continue on our study here. We're in Genesis chapter 25 at verse 19. These are the records of the generation of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. The places they're referring to there is what's modern-day Syria. She would be a Syrian if she was alive today. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Interesting, isn't it? This wife that clearly God had appointed for Isaac, scriptures say that he appointed her. And we know that he has to have a long line of descent. That's the whole purpose of the seed provision in the Abrahamic covenant. She was barren. Who else do we know that was similar situation in life and was barren? Sarah was too, wasn't she? These wives of the players, the key players in the Abrahamic covenant from whom the line of descent must come, are both barren. Sarah for years. And Rebekah for a long time too, about 20. Do you think there's any commonality between those two? What could be going on here, do you think, maybe? You think there's a satanic rat in the crib here? I don't know, but I'm suspicious that there's some satanic activity here wherein he is trying to stop this line of descent. Why are both of these women barren? Abraham's wife and now Sarah's wife, and we'll see a similar situation when we get on down to Jacob. All of the women in this line of descent are having trouble conceiving and bearing these children. And I'm just suspicious that there's a satanic footprint here that's going on with these gals. So Isaac prays for her, and she then conceived after, of course, his prayer and her intercession on behalf of her. And verse 22, the children struggled within her. Children. She's got more than one there, doesn't she? She's got at least twins. And they're struggling within her. Well, how is that possible? I thought that the product of the womb was essentially nothing until it was born. I mean, I've heard that from a lot of people. Therefore, you can do whatever you want to with it. You can destroy it right up to the day before it exits the womb, and you won't be charged with murder or manslaughter or anything else, because it doesn't mean anything. It's not a human being. How come these guys are fighting one another here already? There's some discernment of some kind going on in there, and they're struggling with one another, these children. And she felt that and said, wait a minute here, there's something going on here. Why am I in this way? So she had the good sense to go and inquire of the Lord. Again, we're seeing good positive character here on the part of Rebekah. She goes to the right source to get the answer here. She asks the Lord, what's going on here with these guys? And the Lord answered her in verse 23 and said, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. The one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Well, now, wait a minute. She's got two children in her womb. That's not all that hard to understand. Twins. But the younger of those two is actually going to be the one that is served by the older. The older one, the firstborn, is going to be subservient to the younger. That ain't right. That's not the way the order of nature normally takes place. The older doesn't serve the younger. Or does it? Who did God choose between Isaac and his older brother Ishmael? The younger, didn't he? Joseph was chosen over his older brothers, wasn't he? Judah was chosen over his older brothers. David was chosen over his older brothers. It seems to me that maybe God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. It seems that God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. It seems that God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. 1 Corinthians 1, 27 through 29. Many instances in Scripture of God choosing something that is not the normal order of events. The social customs aren't being followed here. The conventions of normal social life are not being followed here. Tradition is not being followed here. Giftedness or natural endowments are not being followed here. Social privilege or status is not being followed here. None of those things is the key to being the recipient of God's grace. None of those things determine who it is that receives God's election and grace. And in fact, this incident here in Genesis 25:23, Paul uses in the book of Romans in chapter 9, verses 10 through 13, to illustrate the doctrine of election, where he says, not only so, but also when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and not done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call, she was told, the older will serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau I hated. This incident is the prototype illustration of the principle of divine election. But that doesn't seem fair to me. I don't quite groove on the fact that God can pick and choose whoever he wants to. I mean, where am I in that picture? Where's my free will? Where's my choice? Can he do that? Psalm 115:3, but God is in the heavens and he does whatever he pleases. Wow. He doesn't have to check with me. He just does what he pleases. Isaiah 43:13, even from eternity I am he, there is none who can deliver out of my hand, I act and who can reverse it. Sounds to me like maybe he's sovereign, and I'm not. Isaiah 55:8-9, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. Just because we think something is fair or not fair is totally irrelevant. It is God's ways that matter. He says, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. He thinks differently than we do. He acts differently than we do. Our concept of right and wrong and fairness have nothing whatsoever to do with God's plan for man. Because He is sovereign and we are not, He can do what He wants to. Daniel chapter 4, verse 25, that you be driven away from mankind and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle and drenched with the dew of heaven. 7 months, 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and He bestows it on whomever He wishes. So to those who do not accept the principle of divine election, you have to reckon with these passages like this to point out the fact that God is sovereign and He can do anything He wants to do. He doesn't need your approval. He doesn't need your concept of fairness, right, wrong, or anything else to execute His plan for man. He does what He wants to do. And in this case, He wants the older of these two children to serve the younger of these two children, in conflict with the normal customs of the day. And she's told that. That is, Rebecca is told that the older will serve the younger. She knows that now because he tells her. So continuing on, verse 24, when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau, which means hairy. He was a hairy little rascal. And afterwards his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. He's trying to let Esau get out ahead of him there. He's got a hold on him, trying to pull him back. So his name was called Jacob, which kind of means supplanter. So the two boys are named after, I suspect the midwives or whoever was helping here probably named them or helped to name them based upon what they see here in them, first of all. So he's Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. So he's 60 now. Remember, he married at 40. So it's been 20 years now before these two boys are born. So these two guys are about as opposite as you can get. One of them's a hairy little rascal. And the other one's just kind of, he's more smooth. He's kind of silk and lace and that sort of stuff. And when they grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the fields. He's Grizzly Adams. Esau grows up into being, unfortunately, he's not even the gentleman Grizzly Adams is. He's coarser than Grizzly Adams, but he's the outdoor manly type, likes to hunt and all that sort of stuff. And his younger brother, Jacob, was a peaceful man living in tents. He's Rhett Butler. He's a southern gentleman. He's smooth, sophisticated, much more domesticated than Esau. So Esau's out running around in the field killing bears with his bare hands. And Rhett Butler, he's at home hanging around with the family and so on. These guys are about as opposite as you can get. Same guy, same gene pool. About opposites as they can be. Now Isaac, verse 28, loved Esau because he had a taste for game. Now Isaac likes that Grizzly Adams stuff. He likes game. Esau brings him some every now and then. So he kind of gets partial to Esau. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, right off the bat here now, we're seeing at this point in their lives, at this age, we're seeing them make a mistake that is almost a guaranteed recipe for some kind of a problem, and that is they're picking and choosing which children they want to give preference to. Is that a good act of parenting, you think? That's almost a guarantee of problems, isn't it? That will divide a family probably about as quick as anything, is to take sides, is to pick favorites among your children. Could not Isaac have loved Jacob also? And could not Rebekah have also loved Esau? Why do they have to split this thing up like this and favor one over the other? The two boys have been a polarizing influence on their parents, but the parents are not doing a very good job of parenting either, are they? They're not finishing well here. So there's division in the family. Now, what was told to Rebecca about the relative position of these two boys? Already they know, the parents know, that Esau, the older, is going to serve Jacob, the younger. They've been told that. Why then does Isaac continue to prefer Esau over Jacob, the one who clearly is going to be the spiritual leader of the family? Why does he do that? We'll see more about that in just a bit. But first, Esau said to Jacob, oh, wait a minute, pick back up down here on verse 29. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. So there was a day later when Esau comes in from a little hunting expedition and man, he could eat a horse. He's just starving. And his younger brother, Jacob, happened to have some food on the stove called soup, something like that. And Esau said to Jacob, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I'm famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom, which means red. There's something about whatever he had in his stew that gave it a red appearance. So Esau refers to it in that way. He says, give me some of that. I am really hungry. But Jacob said, first, sell me your birthright. Now, could not Jacob have just simply given him, it was his brother, for goodness sake, couldn't he just give him a bowl of this stuff? Jacob seizes upon this opportunity. He is a manipulative type guy. But he seizes upon the opportunity to try to get from Esau something that he, Jacob, wants. He wants this birthright. Now, the birthright is sort of a legal standing in the society of his day. The firstborn in any family occupied a position of both social and legal preference and honor. God refers to Israel as his firstborn. Israel is blessed by God and is honored by God over other nations of the world. So this birthright thing is sort of a right to inherit the honor and wealth of the family, and in this case would include, of course, the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. So Jacob, it appears, is in tune with what God is doing through this family, and he wants to be the next theocratic administrator. He wants to be God's man. Esau doesn't appear to care. The birthright, which would give him both wealth and spiritual leadership of the family, doesn't seem to mean much to Esau, because he says, hey, behold, I'm about to die, so what use then is the birthright to me? He said, hey, birthright's got something to do with the future. I'm hungry now. I want satisfaction now. I don't want to hang around here and wait for something good to happen later. I don't care about that thing. Just give me something to eat. You can have it. And it was transferable, by the way, in that society of the day. So Esau's regard for the opportunity to be God's spiritual leader of the family and of the nation that would come down from them, he doesn't care about. Jacob, on the other hand, he wants it. So he sells the birthright, Esau does. Remember, it would not naturally fall to him because he was the older. He sells it then to Jacob for a bowl of this stew. He makes him swear, first of all, Jacob does. First swear to me. So he swore to him and he sold his birthright to Jacob. So Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now the character of these two men is as different in the spiritual realm as it is in the physical. You got Grizzly Adams over here and Rhett Butler over here, and about as far as you can get apart in character. And their spiritual sensitivity is the same way. One of them has none, Esau. He couldn't care less about the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. He could care less about being the spiritual leader of the family. He just wants to satisfy his belly at the time because he was hungry. And Jacob, the manipulator, takes advantage of that and gets Esau to sell him that privilege and birthright for a bowl of stew. Now, Scripture speaks poorly of Esau because of that. He is reckoned as a coarse and godless, spiritually insensitive man because he didn't care about that birthright and gave it up, sold it so cheaply for a bowl of stew. So this is a mistake that he makes early on in his life that will come back to haunt him in a little bit. So Jacob now finagles that birthright out of Esau for a very, very modest price of a bowl of stew. Okay. We'll come back to that in a little bit. That's just setting the stage for a resumption of what's going on there in a little bit. The manner in which Esau kind of consummates the experience is kind of interesting. He says he ate, he drank, rose, and went away. I mean, it doesn't seem to be any sort of interaction between the two guys at all, does it? He just sits down, he eats, he drinks, and goes. Nothing much going on there between them, as we'll see as we go along here in a little bit. So in this incident, we see the prototype illustration of election, and we see the total disregard for spiritual privilege and benefit on the part of Esau in this deal. All right, we'll come back to that in a little bit. In chapter 26, Isaac needs to learn a little bit about the presence of God and his superintending care of one's life, and so that incident gets inserted in here next. Chapter 26, verse 1, now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. Kind of ringing any bells here? Remember, Abraham did the same sort of thing, didn't he? And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. I guess he was kind of headed on the way down there. He says, stay in the land of which I shall tell you. And then he repeats to Isaac now essentially the same promises contained in the Abrahamic covenant, that involving land, seed, and blessing. Verse 3, the land. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. So the first thing he tells Isaac is, stay in this land, and I'm going to give that to you. So there's sort of a futuristic aspect to God's care and presence with him. He says, I will be with you there in verse 3. And in verse 4, he says, I'll multiply your descendants, that's the seed, as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. There's the blessing. Land, seed, blessing. Same basic three main provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through this seed, because the Savior of the world will come through it. So he repeats to Isaac the same provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. So now the blessings of the covenant are flowing down through Isaac. It has nothing, of course, to do with Ishmael, as we saw before. Now, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, so Isaac lived in Gerar, and the men of the place asked about his wife, and he said, she's my sister. This is like a one-trick pony, isn't it? This family can only do one thing, man. They can represent their wives as their sisters. Other than that, that's about all they got. Golly, he does the same thing. And I'm sure he learned it from Dad. chip off the old block. I'm sure Dad said, hey, man, when you get out there in a place where you think your life's at threat because of your wife, just tell them she's your sister. Nothing bad will happen to you. And so he does the same old thing. Some besetting sins, you just cannot get past them, can't you? They just haunt you your entire life. So it came about when he'd been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and he saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. So he's behaving toward his wife like a husband would, not like a brother would. And the king sees that and he says, wait a minute here. This is not his sister. This is his wife. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she's my sister? And Isaac said, well, because I said, lest I die on her account. And Abimelech says back, what is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and she would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. And once again, we see the godless of the world rebuking, justly so, the godly. Abimelech's behavior is more noble than Isaac's. Isaac lies, misrepresents Rebekah, but Abimelech chastises him, rebukes him because of it. And then again, God working through him, he tells his people to leave them alone. Do not bother either one of these two. So again, divine intervention saves and protects the integrity of the family here, but not because the behavior of the two players, Isaac and Rebekah, warranted it, but just because of God's grace. So similarly to Abraham's experience, things work out okay, but again, is that the smart thing to do? Don't think so. So he's learning some lessons about God's presence and God's ability to deal with him. A few verses to remind you of some of this. Jeremiah 23:23-24, God says, am I a God at hand, declares the Lord, and not a God afar off? Can a man hide himself in secret places so I cannot see him, declares the Lord? Do I not fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord? Isaac, am I away from you somehow or another here? When you moved over to here, did I not come with you? Am I not present in your life at all times and in all places? David expresses the same sentiment in Psalm 39, the second stanza there. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. God's presence is at all times at hand in our lives. He's omnipresent. We can't grasp that totally, I understand that, but just try to realize he is always with you at all times and in all places, and he is there to be a source of help at all times. His presence is omni. It is always there on our behalf. Isaac is having to learn this the hard way here. So now he lives there near the Philistines, and Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. Anybody farming in here? How'd you like to have 100-fold crop production in 1 year? 100 times better than the normal. Wow. Because God was with him. God blessed him in verse 12. And a man became rich, and he continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy, for he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envy him. He is an object of social envy because he is doing so well economically, growing and amassing great wealth, and just doing wonderful. Now, the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. That helps a lot, doesn't it? You know how hard it would be to get water in those kind of areas when you finally get a well working, to have somebody come along and fill that well with dirt. clearly the Philistines are trying to curtail his progress, his success at God's hands, and so they're filling up his wells. So then Abimelech said to him, "Go away from us, for you're too powerful for us." So the whole little mini city nation of the Philistines want to run him off because he's just growing too strong for them. So Isaac departed from there, and he camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up. And after the death of Abraham, and he gave them the same names which his father had given him. So they'd filled up some of the wells that Abraham had dug, and now he's going back to try to reopen those wells and dig them back open again. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek because they contended with him. So he's just kind of given new names to these wells to mark the occasion for how they got reopened. So he dug another well, and they quarreled over it too. So they named it Sitna. And he moved away from there, and he dug another well, and he did not quarrel over it. So he named it Rehoboth. For he said, "At last the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." So he's kind of moving around down there, interacting with the Philistines, and they're kind of battling one another a little bit here, not at open war, but through these economic means of filling up these wells and so on. So then he went up there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said to him, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you." God said he would be with him. Now he says, "I am with you." So he went from the future to the present. "I'll bless you, multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Again, the provisions of the covenant are being reappointed here. So he built an altar there, and he called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. These building of altars, by the way, would be sort of like today, if you started a new community, you'd build a church there, some center of worship. So Isaac is trying to, at least it looks like, honor God and maintain some sort of center of worship for his household, which probably was about as big as Abraham's, around 1,000 people, maybe something like that. So he's at least got some sensitivity going here. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Azahuath and Phicar, the commander of his army. These are probably titles rather than names. That's why they're the same as they were in Abraham's day. And Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me since you've hated me and you've sent me away?" And they said, "Well, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you." Even they can see this. The blessings of his life clearly illustrate the presence of God that is with Isaac at all times. They even recognize it. So he says, "Let there be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So they, even these godless Philistines, recognize God's hands on Isaac's life. So they want a covenant with him. They don't want Isaac turning on them. He could do them some hurt, they think. So they want a covenant. And so then they made them a feast, and they ate and drank. And in the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths. And Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Came about in the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him that about another well they had dug. And they said to him, "We found some water." And so they named it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. And there probably should be a chapter break right there, because this sort of concludes this little sojourn era in Isaac's life where he's learning more about the presence of the Lord and the fact that it is with him at all times. It has been with him. It is with him. It will be with him. But he seems to have to learn this the hard way, and has. Now, the subject matter kind of changes rather abruptly here in verse 34. It says, "When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah." Esau's back on the scene now. Grizzly Adam reappears, but this time he's got two wives. They're both Hittites. Hittites are among the Canaanites, the godless people that Abraham said, "Don't you even take a wife for my wife for my son Isaac from them. We don't want nothing to do with those Canaanites." Well, Esau goes off, and he not only gets him one Hittite wife, he gets him two. He violates God's pattern for marriage, and he violates the principle of not intermarrying with these godless peoples around him, and he picks him up two Hittite wives. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Apparently their lifestyle, their system of values, and all that stuff was very much opposed to that of the godly line, and all they did was bring grief to their parents. It again is another illustration, I think, of the nature of Esau. He has no spiritual insight and sensitivity at all. He doesn't follow God's pattern for marriage. He doesn't marry from the right gene pool. Everything about this guy depicts him as an alien from the commonwealth of the godly line. And so that little bit was just mentioned there. So it comes about when Isaac was old, chapter 27, and his eyes were too dim to see. I think he's about 137 here, if I remember this right. Yeah, about 137. And he's going to live another 43 years, by the way. So he's not quite as finished as he thinks he is. But he's getting on up in age, and his vision is failing him, so that he can't see very well. And so he calls his older son Esau and says to him, "My son." And Esau says, "Here I am." Isaac said, "Behold, now I'm old and I do not know the days of my death. Now then, please take your gear, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt some game for me, and prepare a savory dish for me, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, so that I may bless you before I die." Now, Isaac apparently is thinking, well, I'm not sure how much more time I've got left here, so I better get this blessing that I want to pass along to Esau, I better get this done. Who has God made it clear to already is going to inherit the blessings? Esau? No. This old guy now in his older years is essentially trying to thwart the plan and purposes of God, which have been made known to him years before. Esau ain't the guy, but Isaac keeps trying to make him the guy. Isaac is thinking with his belly. He wants a certain meal that this guy can prepare, a wild game. And he's blowing off the divine will that Jacob will be the one that becomes the next theocratic administrator. And he's going to try to essentially grant that privilege to Esau in spite of that. He's not finishing well. His regard for the will of God, the revealed will of God, is essentially non-existent. Is this the behavior of the next theocratic administrator? Disobeying? Weak? Sensuous? Thinking with his stomach, not his heart? He's not finishing well. Now, the precise difference between this blessing that Isaac is going to try to give to Esau and the birthright, which Esau has already sold, is not real clear in Scripture. It's a little hard to get a real clear definition between the two. The writer to the book of Hebrews kind of treats them as one and the same. And he criticizes Esau as a immoral, godless man who despised sort of the package deal, the both of them. But Esau seems to think that they're separate and distinct because he will lament here in a little bit after Jacob snookers him. he will lament over the fact that Jacob got him twice. He got his birthright and he got his blessing. So he kind of sees something in his mind of being separate between the two. The birthright has more to do with inheritance of the family wealth and role and leadership. The blessing seems to have more to do with a patriarchal prophetic utterance under the guidance of God that sort of establishes the destiny of the family, says what they're going to be like going forward in the affairs of men and this sort of thing. And so there does seem to be a little bit of emphasis difference, a nuance of difference between the two. But the author to the book of Hebrews doesn't try to worry too much about that. He basically just says that Esau blew the whole thing. He blew them both. So in your mind, probably if you just think of them as both the material and spiritual blessings of the family, you're probably okay. Isaac then, he's ready to rock here. He says, you go out there and get me some game and prepare it for me like I want, and I'm going to give you this blessing. I don't care what God wants. I'm going to give it to you, Esau. So he's pretty much out of line in this whole deal, isn't he? Well, here comes lovely Rebekah on the scene, verse 5. She was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau. She's eavesdropping behind the tent curtain there. And she hears this. She hears that Isaac is about to grant to her first son, Esau, something that she wants to go to Jacob, her beloved, her focal point. So, whoa, wait a minute. This is a problem here. We got to put a stop to this somehow. So she gets Jacob in verse 6 and says, behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me some game and prepare a savory dish for me that I may eat and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. So this blessing, see, sort of has a divine approval. It was sort of a superintending announcement by the patriarch in God's presence so that he's sort of speaking for God and knowingly speaking for God. So she recognizes the seriousness of that. So she says to Jacob in verse 8, therefore, my son, listen to me as I command you. This is take charge, Rebekah. She says, Jacob, get up and get going here. I got a plan, and you do what I tell you to do. She says, now go to the flock and bring me two choice kids from there that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, just as he loves. Why is Isaac so crazy about Jacob because he can get him some game when his wife can fix the same thing with goat meat and he doesn't know the difference? Why is it so important that he thinks he's getting something extraordinary from Esau when clearly Esau is out of step with God's plan here anyway? She can fool him by fixing goat meat. I guess you put enough barbecue sauce in it, who can tell the difference, right? So she does something like, she said, go get two of them so that they look about the same size as a deer would or whatever here, two goats. And I'll whip this stuff up. He won't know the difference. Then you shall bring it to your father that he may eat, so that he may bless you before his death. So the plan is, we're just going to snooker old Isaac now. We're going to take advantage of the fact that the guy's practically blind and that he's God's appointed representative for the family. We ain't going to pay attention to that. We're going to just blow this right past him. We're going to go deceive him into thinking that you, Jacob, are Esau and steal the blessing from Esau. See the plan? Deceiving hubby is always a good idea, right? Blow as much smoke as him as you possibly can and see what happens. We'll come back to that thought when we see what happens. That's the plan, you see, based totally on the principle of deception and manipulation. It's the same old thing we've seen before. God ain't getting a job done here, so we're going to help him out. We're going to get for ourselves what God has already said he's going to give us. He said the older would serve the younger. But we're going to make sure that that happens. We're just going to go get it ourselves. We're going to finagle it right out from under them here. Rebecca is not finishing well either. So when she presents the plan, Jacob says, well, wait a minute now. Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I will be as a deceiver in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. So he recognizes the obvious practical problem is, wait a minute, I can't represent myself as Esau. If he feels me, he'll know I ain't him, because Esau's Grizzly Adams, and I'm Red Butler, and we don't feel like the same guy. It's a real problem, a practical, real problem under this scenario of deception. So she says in verse 13, your curse be on me, my son, only obey my voice and go get them for me. She says, if there's any cursing that results from this plan, I'll take that upon me. I'll be the recipients of the curse, not you. You go ahead and do what I told you. Did this plan work out real well? The curse was on her, as we'll see as we finish up the detail. So she says, stop worrying, Jake. Go do what I told you, and I'll take care of it. So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and his mother made savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she gave the savory food and bread which she had made to her son Jacob to take to Isaac. So she costumes him up with some hairy garments, some clothing that covers the bare part of his skin, hands and necks and things that Isaac could possibly touch. I mean, she's got this thought through pretty good. And she makes him out to appear like Esau. And gives him the food. And says, take it in there and give it to your father. And maybe we better throttle back here. Hate to end this right in the middle of this, but if you want to see the rest of the story, you have to come back next week. Got the storyline in mind, okay, in here now. Everything we're seeing right now has a certain stench associated with it, doesn't it? Lying and deceiving and conniving, distrusting God, do it yourself. Everything is wrong in this storyline. These people are not finishing well. The last we saw them, their character was admirable. They were impressive. We liked them. Now they're lying and deceiving and trying to steal things and stuff like that. They are not finishing well. And they won't. Neither one of them. But we'll save the rest of the story till next time when we've got time to finish it. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen here this morning? On the scene comes the next theocratic administrator, Jacob. He doesn't appear to be that at first. It appears that his older brother is, Esau. But God has already said that ain't going to be the way it is. Jacob is going to be the guy. He's already told Rebecca that. But they can't leave it alone. They can't leave it up to God. They have to try to finagle that in both the case of the birthright and now this blessing, whatever the exact differences may be. People are trying to, in essence, finagle for themselves something that God has already promised them that he would give them. They're not trusting him, they're trusting themselves. And they're conniving plots to try to get it. There will be prices to be paid for this. And we'll see those as we go forward. So an unfortunate and unpleasant change in character on the part of both Rebekah and Isaac in this scene. Yeah, Jane?
The two nations, you know, that they were fighting. One, the Jewish nation. Mm-hmm. What was the other one?
Edom. Edom is the nation that will come from Esau. And you remember the Edomites opposed Israel when they came out of the Promised Land, came out of Egypt trying to get to the Promised Land. Edom opposed them, made them go way out and around them. So they became antagonists early on. So it's Israel from Jacob and Edom from Esau are the two nations that he's referring to there. Yeah, Glenda?
Why do the Palestinians think they have the land?
Well, because they're there. I mean, they physically are there. The Palestinians think the land belongs to them because they're physically there, and they don't care about the promises of God. That's why all these people come up with this two-state solution, a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. That ain't going to happen. It's all going to Israel, including the Gaza Strip, where the Philistines are, that these guys have made covenants with, saying that they can keep that land and they won't attack them. No, Israel will occupy all of that land. It all belongs to them. There's only one stretch of land on this planet that has been given to somebody, and that's Israel. We can fight over all the rest of it, but you can't fight over Israel. There's no point in fighting over Israel. God has given it to them. They will have it. The world will not make a liar out of God because they want to occupy that land. But today, you know, there's more Arabs in Israel than there are Jews. There's like 8 million Jews, and about 9 million Arabs. There's a few more Arabs in Israel than there are Jews. But when the Lord returns at the second advent, all of Israel will be occupied by them, and they get it allocated by tribes, and there's a strip, a horizontal strip across there for each of the 12 tribes, Ezekiel chapter 46, 47, 48, along and through there. So all of that land will be the Jews' land. But until then, they will keep fighting over it. And the Palestinians will keep claiming it. Any other questions or comments? You got another 30 seconds. Speak quickly. All right, we'll let you truck, and we'll see you next week, Lord willing. Remember, after next week's class will be Gene's memorial service for anybody that cared to attend it.